Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Please take care of yourself.
Welcome to Fruit Loops, episode 223. Bienvenidos, bitches, and buiti binafi, and thank you for listening and for being here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and those who are othered, and most importantly, the victims, because contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cisgender, able-bodied, white dudes. No.
What?
These crimes rarely get any public attention, and that is because, drum roll, please.
Why?
The news is racist, allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman. And I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white.
That's right. She is. And when we talk about racism, she never finds it necessary to be like, well, not all white people, Wendy, because duh.
And we're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions.
All right, so who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today's subject is Gerald Parker, a.k.a. the Bedroom Basher, a Black man and serial killer responsible for a string of home invasion murders in Orange County, California, in the late 70s. And this subject was suggested to us by True Dark Angel Shy on Twitter.
Ooh, hip hop air horns for True Dark Angel Shy.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, True Dark Angel Shy. Love, 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 lovely. So, before we get into it, how you doing, friend?
I'm doing good. I'm very busy right now.
Oh,
so,
my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody I've been talking to on the phone, like at work, vendors and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, oh, hey, how's it going? Oh, I'm so busy.
So busy.
I'm like, oh my God, me too. I'm glad I'm not the only one. I'm up to my eyeballs in TPS reports. I just got off. I worked for 12 hours today. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, I know.
Ugh.
I know.
Ugh.
In a mediation most of the time. Yes, so you're busy and you're going to hire an assistant to help you. You're going to take a vacation and somebody's going to do all your work for you.
I am going to take a vacation in March.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, I too am very busy and it's just, I guess, embrace the suck is what I'm trying to figure out how to do right now. The weather's warming up, it's tax season almost. And here we are. We're alive, though. That's good, right?
Yes.
Now let's get into some listener laters.
Well, hello, angels. Thank you.
All right. What's in that bag, friend?
Well, I wanted to say thank you to Personnel Touch and Killa Eastax for your 5-star reviews.
Thank you so much. I saw those too. Yes. And there's really wonderful people out there. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I wanted to say, please send any questions or comments to FruitloopsPod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at
602-935-6294.
And we may feature it on a future episode. But if you don't want us to, just let us know and we won't.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we got 2 new Patreons this week.
Right on.
Returning champ, Semenchi, a.k.a. Marlene, Mean Green Marlene, and NB. And right by on. The way, just a reminder, you know, we understand that the struggle is real. I can't tell you how many Patreon accounts I have and I have to cancel because, I have other bills to pay.
Yeah.
And so we totally understand. You can come in and out. We are not going anywhere. So,
and we're not judgmental either.
No. We,
do
my
what
gosh.
You gotta
come
do.
On, Joe Byron, yeah. Forgive our student loans already, please. But we understand. We appreciate it. We just appreciate you rocking with us so much. So thank you, Semenchi. And NB is a new Patreon. And here is your tune. Singing like Semenchi, whoa, whoa. Singing like NB, whoa, whoa. Singing like Aretha, whoa, whoa. Singing like Alicia, whoa, whoa. I sound great when I'm potting in the shower. Ooh. All the fruities give me powers when I'm potting in the shower. Funky, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Just a little sign of our appreciation. We love you guys. So now we're going to take a quick break and we're going to get into the story when we come back.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So
nice.
I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering.
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp.com/fruit.
The truth about the Haditha massacre has been covered up, but not anymore.
I know you know what happened.
They went into houses and killed women and children.
What are you thinking?
What a mess.
U.S. Marines murdered innocent civilians in cold blood.
And at the center of it all
is 25-year-old Sergeant Frank Wooderich.
And me. Murder in House 2. A new podcast from Crowd Network.
And we're back. Remind us, Beth, who is our subject again today?
Our subject today is Gerald Parker, a.k.a. the Bedroom Basher, a serial killer responsible for 6 murders in Orange County, California in the late 70s.
And as far as bad people who did bad things in California, I would say the 70s was their heyday, no?
Yeah, faux show.
We got Manson. We got Golden State, the Golden State guy.
Yeah.
And that's really all I can think about right now. So let's get into our love and light section, where we just offer up love and light to the loved ones of the victims. This was also heavy for the communities in which these crimes occurred. So we want to say love and light to the communities as well. And rest in paradise to all of the victims. And here are their names. Sandra Fry was 17. Kimberly Rollins was 21. Jane D actually survived. Marilyn Carlton, 31. Diana Green was 20 years old. She survived. And her stillborn baby was also a victim, Chantal Green. Deborah Kennedy was 24 years old. Deborah Senior was 17 years old. Aida Demirjuran survived. And Paula S. was 13 years old. And Paula survived as well. So now let's get into the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Well, the murders took place in Orange County, California in the 70s. But our subject today spent much of his formative years in Logan Heights, San Diego. Logan Heights is one of the oldest communities in San Diego and was established in 1867 on land where the Kumeyaay people had lived for thousands of years.
Oh, that's a new one. Kumeyaay.
Yeah.
New to me. Obviously not new to the world. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, that's because we're both fans of Night Country. And a lot of the language that people include, and I'm guilty of this too sometimes, that what we use when we're referring to indigenous folks is like negative, like they're suffering and they are going extinct, right? But there's a resilience that I've observed in indigenous communities. They're not going anywhere. So
yeah,
we don't have to talk about them like they're not here. But anyway, in the 1880s, Logan Heights became a significant subdivision in San Diego, and during the great boom of that period was the location of many beautiful homes. The neighborhood grew slowly but consistently. The area had all the attributes of a good neighborhood. It was accessible to the central area, had fertile soil, and was close to water, yet high enough to offer views of the bay. Sounds luxurious.
Yeah, it does. In 1891, a horse and mule-drawn rail car line was built into the area, which was replaced the next year by the San Diego Electric Railway, which offered service from downtown San Diego to various Logan Avenue points.
Mm.
That's fancy.
It is.
Perhaps because of the ease of accessibility to downtown San Diego, the neighborhood business development lagged, so it was still somewhat rural.
Hard to imagine San Diego.
That area, yeah, being rural. Yeah.
People who were migrants to the area came from many walks of life. The ethnic composition of Logan Heights was fairly typical of other San Diego neighborhoods and included Black folks, Mexican-American people, Asian people, and various people of European ethnic groups.
Restrictive covenants and housing contracts were used in many areas of San Diego, including Logan Heights. And although Mexican-American people were scattered throughout Logan Heights, Black folks were fairly concentrated along just a few blocks.
The semi-rural lifestyle of Logan Heights began to fade shortly after 1900. In 1905, as the area grew, the local business base expanded. Logan Heights' business district reached its height of prosperity in the 1920s. Ah, the Roaring Twenties!
Yes.
With jazz and the Harlem Renaissance.
As Logan Heights became a less desirable place to live, it experienced white flight. Other ethnic groups took their place, and by the late 1920s, this is really early for this, Logan Heights was considered a residential district of Black people, Mexican-American people, and Asian people. And today, it is majority Latinx.
In 1963, I-5 was constructed. I hate that fucking freeway. And it bisected the community. So it literally
went right through a community.
There were people living there, y'all. So what happened to their houses, etc.? In 1969, the Coronado Bay Bridge opened with its on-ramps and support pylons towering over the community. These developments had a devastating effect on Logan Heights as families and businesses found themselves displaced.
Attempting to restore some vitality to the neighborhood, residents asked the city to build a park, where people could go and rest and where children could play. Mm-hmm. Mario Solis, a resident of the community, found out that construction of a California Highway Patrol substation and parking lot had begun while the plea for a community park had gone unheard.
And we've talked about this before, how they will build highways, parking lots right in the middle of where BIPOC and poor people live.
Yeah.
And they don't listen to them when they're asking for, the community said, we want this, we need this, and they ignored it.
Yeah.
Word spread, and on April 22nd, 1970, the residents of Logan Heights walked down to the site under the Coronado Bridge with shovels, pickaxes, and rakes, and constructed a park for the community. Oh, that's beautiful. Halting construction on the CHP substation and giving birth to Chicano Park. Oh, I love this.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Yeah.
Chicano Park is located under the Coronado Bay Bridge, which connects San Diego proper with Coronado, and is a 7.9-acre open space for residents of Southwest San Diego. Mural art forms adorn the bridge support pillars. A kiosk resembling an Aztec temple is located in the park.
That is so rad.
Yeah.
Residential displacement by industry has resulted in a mixed-use residential/industrial area, further eroding residential land values. Industries brought an estimated 50,000 jobs to the community, but residents say most of the jobs have gone to outsiders. The noise, odors, traffic, and associated problems have also hurt the community image of Logan Heights, not to mention their health from all that shit.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's get into the early life of Gerald Parker. What do you got, Beth?
Gerald Parker was born in 1955 in Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh.
He was one of 10 siblings.
Hmm.
His mother died giving birth to her 10th child when Jerry was just 8 years old.
Hmm.
His father then abandoned the family.
That's really sad. Jerry lived with his grandmother for a few months, and while there, he got in trouble for sniffing glue and was sent to juvenile hall. Afterwards, he and a brother went to live with an older cousin, Florence Russell, in Logan Heights, San Diego.
And she was quite a bit older. She had kids and everything.
Okay. Auntie Florence?
Yes, Auntie Florence. According to Florence, Jerry's mother's death and his father's abandonment, quote, broke up the whole family, destroyed them, unquote. Mm. And Jerry was never the same after that. But Florence raised Jerry the best she could, treated him as her own child, and she said that he treated her with respect and kindness.
Jerry went to high school at Boys Republic, a private all-boys school for troubled adolescents located in Chino Hills, California. He did well there and won some awards. However, Jerry later told a psychiatrist that between the ages of 7 and 15, he regularly sniffed glue, paint, and paint thinner, began using marijuana at age 11, used PCP, mushrooms, LSD, and injected speedballs, which is a combo. May I have the speedball combo? Oh, we don't serve that here. This is in and out. Oh, well, it's a combination of heroin and cocaine. Can you get it to me now? Nope, still just a burger joint.
In 1973, at the age of 18, he joined the Marine Corps. And after basic training, he was stationed in Adak, Alaska, where he said that he first tried alcohol. He claimed that he then began drinking every day, including when he was on duty.
I don't think we should be surprised by his continued reaching for things to cope and escape. And there's no intervention anywhere in those, 8-9 years of his life. It makes sense. But Jerry met another Marine named Albert Garcia when they were both stationed in Adak. They became roommates when they were stationed in Tustin, California from 1974 to 1977. According to Albert, the two partied together on the weekends, drinking alcohol and sometimes smoking marijuana and PCP. I was going to say, wow, that sounds like a fun weekend, but then you add PCP and I'm not interested.
No, thank you. Albert described Jerry as intelligent, quiet, mellow, very respectable, and a model Marine who was promoted to staff sergeant in 5 years. He said he never saw Jerry get into a fight and thought Jerry had good control over his temper. He did not believe Jerry had an alcohol problem, and he had never seen Jerry behave violently after using alcohol or drugs.
retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Larry Huster, Jerry's commanding officer from 1978 through 1979, while he was a staff sergeant assigned to a heavy transport helicopter squadron in Tustin, later testified at trial regarding Jerry's job performance.
He said that Jerry was the material chief for the squadron, a difficult job that served a very critical function relating to the flight readiness of the squadron and required exceptional dedication to the task at hand. He received outstanding evaluations from very demanding superiors and had the tremendous honor of being recommended for Warrant Officers School.
Huster saw Jerry on a weekly basis and thought he was a good Marine. He never knew Jerry to be intoxicated or hungover or to have a drug or alcohol problem. He explained the Marine Corps had a zero-tolerance policy for the use of drugs or alcohol while on duty, especially for aviation units, where lives were on the line, and minimum performance could not be tolerated, even in training situations. So how did he do it?
I don't know. I'm really baffled by this story. I don't know if his reporting of the amount of drugs and alcohol he was doing was not true. I don't know. But Huster did not believe it would be possible for someone on drugs or alcohol to perform Jerry's job, as it required an exceptional amount of motivation. But according to Jerry, he drank a case of beer and a half a fifth of vodka every day for a 10 to 11 year period. He also claimed to have suffered 5 head injuries, 3 of which resulted in unconsciousness.
That's a lot. But
yeah,
if you've got your serial killer bingo card ready. Head injury. Yeah,
head injury.
So he claimed that his drinking and drug use reached the point where he was not reporting to work. And by mid-1979, he was about to be kicked out of the military. However, although he was dishonorably discharged in 1980, it was for felony conviction, not for substance abuse.
Parker said he had always had problems meeting women and never developed relationships with them. He never married and never had a girlfriend. And he was a good-looking guy. He was a decent-looking guy.
Yeah.
He later told a psychiatrist that he, quote, always thought of raping women, unquote. So there was something wrong. Something right.
Yeah, but I we'll get into it in our takeaways. I mean, that primary relationship with the matriarch or the female in his life who was supposed to, you know, like be there for him.
Right.
Was severed to
the
death.
She was gone.
Yeah. So anyway, now let's get into the timeline. So from 1975 to 1978, Parker was stationed at the Marine Base in Tustin. His only close friend was Albert Garcia. Between 1978 and 1979, Parker was transferred from Tustin to El Toro, where he spent just a few months. He described his lifestyle at this time as revolving around drinking and using drugs.
According to Parker's later confession, on December 1st, 1978, he was driving around when he parked near an apartment complex near Buena Park, climbed a fence, and went in through the back of the complex. In one apartment, he saw a girl sitting at the table in the kitchen with her back to the living room window. It was 17-year-old Sandra Fry.
Sandra was one of 10 siblings. Her sister Judith described her as very compassionate and loving, the kind of person who would bring home stray animals. Sandra had moved out of the family home just 3 days earlier.
Parker said he went through an open bedroom window, and after watching Sandra for several minutes, he came up behind her and hit her on the head 2 or 3 times with a 2x4. He then dragged her into her bedroom and later on the bed, took off her underwear and his pants, and then ejaculated on her. He then exited through the same window that he had entered.
This is so random, right?
Yeah.
Just pulled over somewhere and noticed somebody sitting in the window.
So I think he was a peeping Tom and had been for a long time.
Okay. Thank you, OG of True Crime. So when Sandra's roommate, Georgina Stevenson, returned home that evening, she found Sandra in her bedroom lying unresponsive across the bed and nude from the waist down. Her blouse was pulled up, exposing her bra, and there were obvious signs of trauma to her head.
Paramedics transported her to the hospital, where she was pronounced dead. A pathologist determined that Sandra had died from hemorrhaging caused by cerebral lacerations and skull fractures from an unknown number of blows to her head with a blunt instrument.
Contradicting Parker's claim that Sandra was unaware of his presence before he struck her in the head and rendered her unconscious, there were signs of a struggle in the apartment, and Sandra suffered injuries to her face and neck that were consistent with a struggle. A latent fingerprint was lifted from the bedroom window that was years later matched to Parker's left index finger.
So this is another thing that is confusing about this story. Parker, in almost every case, says that they were sleeping or he came up behind them or something like that. They didn't know he was there, so there was no struggle.
Yeah.
But clearly there were signs of struggle.
Yeah.
So I don't know why. Why he did that, but yeah, he's lying.
Okay, Beth.
On March 31st, 1979, 21-year-old Kimberly Rollins was alone in a one-bedroom apartment in Costa Mesa that she shared with a roommate named Roberta. Kimberly had just moved out of the apartment she had shared with her sister Cheryl.
Cheryl described Kimberly as her best friend and a very happy and giving person who wanted to have many children. The sisters' plan had been for Kimberly to help Cheryl through her first 2 years of college, and then Cheryl would help Kimberly with her first 2 years of college. That's so sweet. Did you and Minnie make any deals like that?
Nope.
Okay.
We should have, but we didn't.
I was just wondering. Okay.
A friend had left her ID at the apartment, and at about 11:30, she came over with her date to retrieve it. The couple spoke with Kimberly for a short time before leaving sometime after midnight. Kimberly asked them to leave the door unlocked on their way out because Roberta didn't have a key to the apartment and Kimberly was going to go to bed.
According to Parker, he was outside an apartment window listening to three people inside talking. The man and one of the women left, leaving the other woman alone in the apartment. He then drove around for about an hour before coming back.
He entered the apartment through the unlocked front door with the intent to rape the woman. He found the woman sleeping in the bedroom in the nude. Parker said that, and remember, this is all from Parker's point of view.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. Parker said that he struck her two or three times with a 2x4 and attempted to rape her. He said he left the apartment the same way he entered and threw the 2x4 onto a garage roof.
Are 2x4s just things people in the 70s had lying around their house?
Well, that's what Parker claims, that they were just lying around everywhere, but I don't think so. I don't know where he got these 2x4s.
He's just random 2x4s.
Just laying around everywhere.
Yeah, okay. Just I wasn't around in the 70s, so I don't know.
I don't remember seeing 2x4s everywhere.
Okay, thanks, Beth. So Kimberly's roommate, Roberta, returned home at about 4:45 a.m. on April 1st. The front door of the apartment was ajar. Hearing what sounded like a heavy sigh or forced breath, Roberta went into the bedroom and found Kimberly unresponsive, wearing only an open bathrobe and lying half on and half off of her bed.
Kimberly's face had been badly beaten. Believing Kimberly to be dead and thinking the person responsible could be inside their apartment, Roberta fled to a neighbor's house to call the police. Kimberly was pronounced dead soon after the paramedics arrived.
That was smart, though, for her to go and call.
Yeah.
In a safe place.
Right.
If you love true crime and you don't want to die. I mean, that's a great tip. So an autopsy showed that Kimberly had died from brain contusions with subdural hematoma as the result of multiple skull fractures from a beating with a blunt object. Semen was found at the scene, which much later in the 90s was matched to Parker's DNA.
On July 19th, 1979, Jane Dee, who was living alone in her Costa Mesa apartment, went to bed between 11 and 11:30 p.m. According to Parker, he had been drinking that night and entered the apartment through an open dining room window.
He found Jane sleeping in the nude and hit her in the head with a 2x4. But according to Jane, she was awakened by noises in the hallway. When she went to investigate, a man grabbed her and told her to shut up, after which she lost consciousness. During the brief encounter, Jane did not notice any signs of his being intoxicated.
Another one where... was he drunk?
Yeah. Or, I mean, if you're drunk, how in the world am I supposed to parkour my ass up through a window? I don't, without hurting myself?
And if somebody's drunk, you smell the alcohol, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
So the next morning, a friend coming to see Jane found the apartment door open a few inches and Jane lying unconscious in bed on her back. Her eyes were swollen. There were scratches on her face and bruising behind her ear. She looked like, quote, a prize fighter after a fight, unquote.
That paints the picture.
Yeah.
Jane was taken to the hospital, where she remained in a coma for about 4 weeks, but she survived. However, she had suffered an ear-to-ear skull fracture and required a permanent tracheostomy as a result of having been strangled.
Wow.
Yeah. And as a result of permanent nerve damage, she had problems chewing and difficulty forming words. DNA extracted from Jane's rape kit was later matched to Parker's profile.
We are gathered here today to give you permission to plan the wedding that you want.
I'm Jessica Bishop.
And I'm Sari Wienerman.
And we're the hosts of the Bouquet Toss podcast.
Today's couples have to juggle so many things, from family expectations to outdated traditions and what's currently trending.
So to make it easier, we're going deep to figure out why we do weddings the way that we do, so you can decide what to keep and what to toss from your wedding day plans.
You are cordially invited to subscribe to the Bouquet Toss wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcast.com.
By the power vested in us, we pronounce you free to plan your day your way.
Ohio is a land of mystery, from missing shipwrecks and lost treasure beneath her surface to strange phenomena slicing through her skies. From myths that have evolved around historic events and people to the unsolved murders and disappearances that keep her communities wondering what happened. Find Ohio Mysteries on your favorite podcast app and let's explore the inexplicable. OhioMysteries.com.
On September 14, 1979, 31-year-old Marilyn Carlton and her 9-year-old son Joseph, then known as Joey, were living in an apartment in Costa Mesa. Joseph described his mother as, quote, everything a young boy like myself at the time would want in a mother. She cared, protected, guided, put me before herself, and loved me like only a mother could. She was everything to me, unquote.
Parker describes scaling a back wall and entering Marilyn's apartment through an unlocked sliding glass door. Marilyn was asleep in her bed with a nightlight on. Parker hit her in the head 3 or 4 times with the intention of knocking her unconscious so that he could rape her.
Parker said when he exited the bedroom, he bumped into Joey in the dark hallway and the boy asked, quote, what's wrong with mommy, unquote. Parker did not say anything, moved the boy aside, and left the apartment the same way he entered.
Joseph later testified how his mother, screaming his name, woke him in the middle of the night. Joseph said he was at her bedroom door when it opened and a dark-skinned man pushed past him, ran down the hallway, and left the apartment.
Inside the bedroom, Joseph turned on the light and found his mother lying on the floor, propped up against her nightstand, incoherent and bleeding. When he realized he could not stop the bleeding, he called the operator.
Mm.
No 911 at that time.
Oh, thank you. But also, I feel so bad for little Joey.
Yeah.
Joey met the police outside saying his mother had been hurt, and he directed the officer to Marilyn's room. Marilyn was found covered with blood with a large wound on top of her skull.
Paramedics transported Marilyn to the hospital where she died the next day from subarachnoid and subdural hemorrhage and cerebral contusions as a result of blunt force trauma.
Mm. In September of 1979, 20-year-old Diana Green, who was 9 months pregnant, was living in an apartment in Tustin with her husband, Kevin, who was in the Marines. The two were very young when they married and had a somewhat volatile relationship, as a lot of us do in our early relationships, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Too young, really.
So, yeah. To
be able to figure out how to work relationships.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's hard.
Yeah. On the night of September 30th, they had gotten into an argument, and Kevin left the apartment in kind of a huff to go get some fast food. He unfortunately did not lock the door behind him when he left. He noticed a black man loitering at the complex, but thought nothing of it.
According to Parker, he was drunk that night, and he parked near the Green's apartment complex and started walking around. He heard the argument between Diana and Kevin and saw Kevin leave. Oh my God! Also, Isn't it illegal to drive drunk and drink and drive in the 70s? Oh, Did we have that yet?
You know, it was, but they weren't so severe about it.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Just wondering.
Yeah. But I think he didn't care. I mean.
Right. And that's one of my takeaways, because I heard his confession tape or like his police interviews, and he just sounds like somebody who doesn't really care.
Does not give a fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So after waiting a bit and drinking more alcohol, he entered the apartment through the unlocked front door. Diana, who was noticeably pregnant, she was actually 9 months pregnant and 2 weeks
from
her due date.
Oh, yeah. Oh my.
Yeah. So she was about to give birth. And she was lying on the bed in the bedroom. Parker hit her in the head with a board he had picked up outside of the apartment and then raped her.
Oh my God. At 2:15 a.m., a law enforcement officer responded to a call from the apartment and was met outside by Kevin, who appeared to be in a state of shock and said his wife had been injured.
Officers found Diana in the bedroom, unconscious and lying on the bed nude. She was having difficulty breathing and was bleeding from a 2-inch hole in the middle of her forehead, as well as from her ear and nose. There was blood everywhere.
The wound to her head was so deep it exposed brain tissue and was so pronounced, the officer initially believed she had been shot. Diana was transported to the hospital. Initially, an obstetrician was able to detect a fetal heartbeat, but several hours later, her unborn fetus, Chantal, ceased to have vital signs and was delivered stillborn via C-section.
Diana spent 10 days in a coma and remained in the hospital for about 3 weeks. When she regained consciousness, she had total amnesia and could not remember anyone, let alone what had happened to her. She had to learn to talk and spell all over again, a process that took years.
Oh, and then imagine learning that your baby didn't survive. I just can't imagine how difficult that was. Kevin told officers that he was not home at the time of the attack. He said that he had left the apartment, went to Jack in the Box for food, and when he returned, he found his wife had been attacked.
An employee at Jack in the Box told police that Kevin had been there, and police noted at the time that the food in his possession was warm. Kevin also told officers about the black man loitering at the complex.
It's interesting that in this case, the black man didn't go very far, but unfortunately, it is a common excuse in Western society.
Right.
And welcome to Culture Corner with Wendy and Beth. The "a black man did it" defense is a real thing, and throughout much of American history, it's been one of the most effective ways for a white person who had misbehaved or committed a crime to evade accountability and use a black person as a scapegoat for the actual culprit. But again, I'm pointing it out, but it didn't happen in this case, which is very strange. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, in this case, police zoned in on Kevin as a suspect when the rape kit came back and the sample taken matched his blood type. There was no DNA testing at the time, and blood typing was one way used to narrow down a suspect. So there's only a few blood types.
O,
but,
A, B, anything else?
Yeah, O positive, O negative, what, A, B, A, B, what?
Yeah, yeah. Just a bunch of letters. Like alphabet soup.
Yeah, a bunch of letters, mm-hmm. But not a lot of blood types. So it's really only a way to narrow down a suspect. You can't use it
to pinpoint.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Yes. But also interestingly is that most black people are O type, positive or negative, including myself. Wow. Hello. And I thought this was interesting because of the DNA and blood. And you know how it gets down. Approximately 45% of Caucasians are type O positive or negative, but 51% of black people are African Americans and 57% of Latinx or Hispanic people are type O.
Oh.
Minority and diverse populations therefore play a critical role in meeting the constant need for blood. Call it a culture corner, whatever. I don't know.
I am also type O.
I know. We're the same blood type.
So Kevin's fate was sealed when Diana, quote unquote, remembered that Kevin had attacked her. And you have to remember that she had a major brain injury. And one show I watched, it was Cold Case Files or something like that.
Yeah, I watched that one too.
Mm-hmm. they were talking about how they cautioned the family not to feed her information because she would form a memory around it.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know exactly what happened.
Okay.
But
okay.
She said she recalled Kevin hitting her with his keys.
Okay.
And who knows? Maybe he did at one time hit her with his keys.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe she decided that that's what happened that night.
Okay.
Anyway, neighbors remembered hearing what they thought was the Greens fighting on the night of the attack, which is what happened because mm-hmm. they were fighting,
mm-hmm.
and noted that the couple fought often during the course of their short marriage, which was true.
Yeah, Kevin didn't shy away from that.
No,
yeah.
He was like, yep, that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But he did not attack his wife.
Right. So 3 months after the attack, Kevin Green was arrested and charged with assault with a deadly weapon and the murder of his full-term daughter. Diana's brain damage from the trauma was so severe that when the trial went to court a year after the incident, she still had trouble giving a coherent testimony and struggled to spell her own last name for the court record.
But Kevin was convicted of the second-degree murder of Chantel and of assaulting and attempting to murder his wife. He was committed to prison in November of 1980 for a term of 15 years to life.
On October 6th, 1979, 24-year-old Deborah Kennedy was home alone in a Tustin apartment. Late that night, or during the early morning hours, Parker said he took a mallet he found in the back of a pickup truck parked close by and entered Deborah's apartment through a window that was cracked open.
It's interesting how he's going to these places and just finding weapons to use.
Finding weapons and finding unlocked doors and windows.
Yeah.
So
I think he's looking for unlocked doors and windows. And I don't know about the weapons, but I have a hard time believing that he is finding 2x4s everywhere. And I mean, don't you think he would have brought the weapon with him?
I think so. I mean, I don't know what, I really don't know what to believe. Part of me thinks,
yeah.
Okay, so if this was a predominantly black and brown working class like area, it would make sense if there were like pickup trucks, people who worked in construction, people who worked doing landscaping.
Tools and stuff like that.
Pool work. Yeah, so it makes sense that there would be a lot of pickup trucks and tools and supplies around, but always available to him seems so convenient.
Yeah.
Like, I can never find a pen. I have to write all the time, but I can never find a pen. And if I had Parker's luck, I would never be out of pens.
There'd be pens everywhere.
Exactly.
So when he entered the living room, he saw Deborah sleep on the floor, leaning against the couch with the television on. She had a blanket over her, but Parker claimed that she was not wearing any clothes, which would be weird, but okay. He hit her on the head with the mallet, then raped her.
When Deborah's sister returned to the apartment the next day at about 6 p.m., the front door was open and Deborah was lying naked in an exaggerated spread eagle position on a blood-soaked mattress on the floor of her bedroom, covered with a knitted shawl.
Deborah was dead. She had massive blunt force trauma to her face and head, and the pathologist who performed the autopsy said her injuries would have required at least 5 blows from a blunt instrument delivered with a large amount of force.
Hmm.
Later testing of the semen swabbed from Deborah's body revealed a DNA profile that matched Parker.
On October 20th, 1979, Deborah Chamberlain and 17-year-old Deborah Senior went together to a party in Fountain Valley, California. Because both are named Deborah, we're going to call Deborah Chamberlain Deborah C and Deborah Senior just Deborah. About 10:30 p.m., Deborah left in Deborah C's car to return home alone to the apartment they shared in Costa Mesa. Deborah C was going to get a ride home from a friend.
According to Parker, that night he pretended to be a jogger in the neighborhood while he looked in windows.
Wow.
Yeah. He saw Deborah's apartment was empty and he entered through a bathroom window. How did he see that her apartment was empty? He was looking through the windows and peeking mm-hmm. through every window.
Yeah, the math ain't mathing. So
he's a creeper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he'd been hiding, he said, he'd been hiding in the bathroom for about 20 minutes when Deborah came home.
Okay, so when Deborah fell asleep on the couch, Parker exited the bathroom. Oh, he was already in the house.
Yeah.
exited the bathroom and hit Deborah in the head 2 or 3 times with a 2x4, rendering her unconscious. He then carried her into one of the bedrooms, laid her on the floor, removed her underwear, and raped her.
Deborah C. arrived about 2:30 a.m. and found Deborah lying on the floor of her bedroom near the foot of the bed, unclothed except for a pair of socks. She had suffered severe head trauma, and her hair was matted with blood.
A torn blouse and unsnapped bra had been pulled up around her shoulders. Buttons from the blouse were found on the floor next to her body. A green towel had partially been wrapped around her neck. Torn underwear was lying on a pair of shoes near the bed, and the contents of a purse were on the floor near her feet.
So this was kind of a violent attack.
Terrifying.
Deborah died as a result of a hemorrhage from a cerebral laceration and contusions caused by blunt force trauma with skull fractures. Blood spatter at the crime scene was consistent with Deborah's not having moved after being struck on the right side of the head while lying on the bed. So he claimed that he hit her when she was on the couch, but obviously that's not true.
Right, right.
Yeah.
One of the handprints lifted from the windowsill was later matched to Parker's left palm, and later testing of the semen swabbed from Deborah's body revealed a DNA profile that matched Parker's.
On February 2nd, 1980, Parker was visiting his brother in Pasadena when he attacked Aida Demirjian as she was getting out of her car in an underground parking structure. Mm. So this is different.
Yeah.
It's outside, not in a home.
Mm-hmm.
He hit her 2 or 3 times in the head with an iron rod. She fell down and pretended to be unconscious, but Parker kept hitting her.
The two struggled, but Aida was able to get away and ran for help. She was hospitalized for several days and required surgery and physical therapy to repair a skull fracture and several broken fingers. Shout out to her for surviving. That's amazing.
Yeah. Parker was detained about a block and a half away. He was described as calm, cooperative, and compliant, and did not appear intoxicated when he was detained and taken into custody.
On February 15th, in 1980, less than 2 weeks later, 13-year-old Paula S. attended her father's funeral. At about 3:30 p.m., she was walking home from a store in Tustin where she'd bought her mother a birthday present, and a black van drove past her and pulled over. Parker got out and went around the back of the van as though he were checking the tire.
As Paula walked by the van, he grabbed her by the sweater, punched her in the face, and threw her into the van and drove off.
Oh.
Yeah. While driving, Parker kept looking at Paula through the rearview mirror saying, quote, stay down, or I'll kill you,
oh,
unquote.
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
Also, he is like ramping up as far,
yeah.
You know, this was a terrible thing that he did behind closed doors, but now we're out in the open
now,
and that's terrifying.
And 2 weeks between these two attacks.
Yeah. So he later stopped in the parking lot of a small shopping center, got into the back of the van and raped this little girl. Afterward, he asked Paula personal questions. What? Such as what her name was and how old she was.
When it was dark, he drove close to where she lived and dropped her off in an alley, threatening to kill her if she told anybody. But when she got home, Paula told her mother immediately what had happened, and the police were called. Paula had noticed that the man had been wearing shiny shoes, and police thought he was probably in the military.
Mm. An investigation led to Parker, and when interrogated a few days later, he confessed. Later, he commented that it probably saved the girl's life that she was so young. Fuck out of here. That is disgusting. Where's my
shut up?
So on May 13th, 1980, Parker was convicted of kidnapping and rape. He was sentenced to 6 years in prison. And it was this crime that got him dishonorably discharged from the Marines. Wow.
In February of 1984, while Parker was incarcerated at the state prison in Tehachapi, California, for the rape, he attacked his cellmate, David Fuerdo. While David was sleeping, Parker began hitting him in the back of the head with a curved piece of steel, approximately 2 feet in length. Where do
but
you get
why?
Something like that in prison?
But why? Yeah. Parker, why? Oh, my God. He just kept, like, helping
himself.
He can't stop. Oh, my
yeah.
God. So David chased Parker out of the room, but presumably it's a cell, and into the hallway, but had to sit down because he was bleeding profusely and almost passed out. The 3 to 4 inch cut on his head required stitches, and he stayed in the hospital facility for a week. Parker did not say why he attacked. Okay, I'm glad somebody asked at least. He didn't say why he attacked David, but later claimed that David was stealing from him.
Okay.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
So now we're going to get into the investigation and the arrest. Hit it, Beth!
Parker was in prison in June of 1996 when DNA testing connected him to the five murders and to Diana Greene's attack. Law enforcement officers subsequently interrogated him five times about these crimes.
I love it when DNA comes through. I really do. So at first, Parker claimed innocence. I ain't do nothing. And when he was confronted with the fact that his DNA matched the evidence in the crimes, he responded, quote, "I don't know what to tell you," unquote.
I'm sure you don't.
You don't say. So an officer asked Parker if he had ever experienced violent tendencies on PCP or if it was possible he had, quote, "met a girl, saw a girl, followed a girl home, and then whatever happened, happened," unquote.
Parker didn't think he, quote, "could forget something like that," unquote. He continued to deny culpability until later that day when he said it was possible he had killed someone while under the influence of drugs because sometimes he blacked out and would do and say things he didn't remember.
Interesting. Blame it on the goose. Got you feeling loose. Blame it on Patron. Got you in the zone. Blame it on the alcohol. Blame it on the alcohol. So
that's what he's
doing. That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
So finally that afternoon, Parker confessed to the homicides. He began with Diane Greene's attack, saying, quote, "I believe that there is a man on death row because of something that I did. And out of all these murders and the crimes that I committed over the years, that was the one that bothered me the most," unquote.
When asked, "How many women do you think you attacked?" Parker was not sure. He couldn't recall his first attack, but he did deny attacking any women in other states where he had been stationed. But I wouldn't be surprised if he had.
I wouldn't either, friend. So Parker claimed his intent had been only to knock the women unconscious so he could sexually assault them. He claimed it never occurred to him that he was killing the women because once in a fight, he had knocked his opponent out by hitting him in the head with a 2x4. And this did not kill that man. So,
yeah, so
the
obviously,
logic, yeah.
Yeah.
So I didn't do it. Can't take me to jail. Bye.
And in June of 1996, Kevin Greene, Diana Greene's husband, was released from custody after an Orange County Superior Court judge set aside his convictions and dismissed the case against him.
Finally, though. That's a long time. So now we're going to get into the trial. Well, let me tell you what happened. All of Parker's interrogations were audio or video recorded. These recordings were played for the jury, and transcripts of the recordings were provided to the jurors. Parker presented no evidence during the guilt phase and engaged in limited cross-examination of the prosecution's witnesses.
In opening and closing arguments, the defense conceded identity, but relied on Parker's statements to argue he was guilty of only second-degree murder based on diminished capacity due to intoxication. But he was found guilty.
No, really? Oh my gosh. The system, it looks like in this instance, the system did work.
It worked, yeah.
At the penalty phase, the prosecution relied on the facts and circumstances of the murders, including the impact on the victims' families, and introduced evidence regarding the additional acts of violence.
So the attack on Paula and David.
So
and
many Aida. Examples. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Parker testified on his own behalf, and Albert Garcia also testified on his behalf. Also presented was the expert opinion of a forensic psychiatrist. Parker had been diagnosed with organic mental syndrome, a psychological issue caused by brain damage, unspecified psychotic disorder, chronic alcohol abuse, and major depression.
However, the prosecution's expert forensic psychiatrist diagnosed him with antisocial personality disorder, or psychopathy, and Parker was sentenced to death. So now let's get into where are they now? Tell us, Beth.
Well, Parker is 68 years old and is currently incarcerated at San Quentin Prison.
Oh.
And he's still on death row, but it's California. Yeah. So
he'll be there for a while. Indefinitely, I guess.
Yes.
In October 1999, Governor Gray Davis awarded Kevin Green $620,000 in compensation for the years he spent in prison for a crime he did not commit. He moved to Missouri, where his parents lived, and remarried.
Diana and her parents still held Kevin partially responsible for the attack. Diana claimed that Kevin beat her and left her semi-conscious in the couple's apartment just before Parker entered through an unlocked kitchen door and struck her with a 2x4 and raped her.
Now, I can't remember in the episode, TV show, was Diana ever interviewed? I don't remember seeing her.
No.
Yeah, okay.
Not there.
Okay. So Kevin denies ever striking his wife, but has said he does feel partially responsible because he left her alone in an unlocked apartment.
Diana filed a wrongful death lawsuit shortly after Green's conviction and won a multi-million dollar judgment by default because Green was incarcerated. When he was freed from prison in 1996, Kevin filed a countersuit to have the judgment thrown out.
An Orange County Superior Court judge voided the original judgment, but allowed Diana to file an amended lawsuit. However, he encouraged both sides to settle instead of going to trial. In December of 1999, they settled, finally bringing closure to the two-decade-long legal ordeal for Kevin Green, and also for Diana.
Yeah, although her ordeal is never going to be over.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into what we think made Parker snap and our takes. What do you think, Beth?
Well, a couple of things stuck out to me on this story.
Okay.
I've mentioned them already here and there. Mm-hmm. One is that he claimed he was abusing drugs and alcohol, but nobody reported that they saw him intoxicated and he was like doing his job and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So was he really good at hiding it or was he lying? I don't know. But I tend to think he's a liar.
Okay. Say more. Tell me more.
Something else that we didn't really get into was that he often claimed when the women were sleeping that they were sleeping in the nude.
Yes.
But they weren't.
Right.
Their clothes were pulled or torn off of them. Mm-hmm. So what the hell is that?
Great question.
Was he trying to say something like they deserved it because they
That's
were sleeping
what I was
in
thinking.
The nude?
Yeah, because back before we as a society knew better, that was common. Well, what were you wearing?
Yeah,
and now nowadays you would get slapped for saying that
for
to
that,
somebody who had
yeah.
been attacked. But back then, part of me thinks because he was so manipulative,
she was sleeping in the nude.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
it feels like it feels victim blamey, and at the time was probably acceptable. I don't know to say that.
Like the one where the lady fell asleep in front of her couch and he said she was naked, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible, but not likely that
I agree
a woman would do that. Yeah.
I couldn't agree
it's
more.
It's just weird.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I don't know. I've never been a nudist. I have had nudist friends.
I mean, I know people.
Yeah,
I know people who like to not wear clothing. So it is possible, but it's not likely.
It does seem far-fetched, but.
Yes. And the crime scenes often didn't fit his narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Like we talked about, he would say that he attacked these women when they were asleep they didn't know he was there. Mm-hmm. But the evidence suggested there was a struggle.
Yeah.
In any case, it seems to me that he was a habitual liar and very, very angry and violent.
I agree.
Hated women.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the loss of his mother early on in life.
Yeah.
And even though it wasn't his mom's fault that she died,
no,
I can see in a little boy's mind feeling like she left me.
Yeah. And I will grant that his childhood was sad.
Oh, yeah.
And according to his cousin or his auntie who raised him, his mother was a wonderful mother.
Yeah.
Her loss devastated Parker. And he experienced a double abandonment from the death of his mother and then when his dad abandoned the family. So there was both of those abandonments.
A lot in a little amount of time for a little person to process. A young person.
And, you know, I doubt he got any mental health help, given the time period.
The time period, yeah. And it seems evident, you know, by those diagnoses that were thrown out during the trial that no help was ever administered or rendered to him, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, my thoughts, I felt immediately looking at the time frame that he probably was angry, not just because of what happened in his family, but also I think about what America was like in the late 70s. Like there was...
It was a shitty time for a black man to grow up.
Yeah. I mean, and unemployment and poverty and war and displacement and... I don't know if Reagan was in office yet, but...
Not yet.
Yeah.
No,
it was Jimmy...
1980.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a lot. A lot. There was a lot to be angry about. And he seemed to me like he was never really able to connect particularly with people of the opposite sex. You know, he never had
Or very many people, period.
In general.
His only friend was
he only
the
had
one guy.
Friend.
Yeah.
And I understand why he turned to substances to cope, right? The opposite of addiction is connection. That's what they say in all these like woo-woo-y get well places.
but did he though? Because obviously he did dabble in some drugs.
But was
and
he
alcohol,
really addicted?
But was it as bad as he said?
Yeah, I am not sure. Because again, he said a lot of things I think to minimize
his
crimes. Actions.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so maybe.
And it was also suggested to him.
Yes.
By a police officer.
Yeah.
Well, were you doing drugs?
Doing drugs. Yes. And then he just went with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, if the police is suggesting that, you know, it could have been drugs,
yeah,
I'm just going to go
exactly
with it.
What, yeah. That's
totally.
Exactly what happened.
Officer, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. And then, so I understand why he would have been angry. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's unjustified. What is unjustified is
no,
how
what he did,
yeah,
with
what
that
he
anger.
Did with that anger. And I just think of so many, even though mental health wasn't a topic of conversation, especially in the Black community at the time, taking care of ourselves has always been important, right? Our health has always been important. Being well has always been important. So I don't know. I guess I'm disappointed that there was never anything available to him to help him with these issues because maybe people's lives could have been spared.
Yeah.
And then the husband served so much time for a crime he didn't commit.
Yeah. And it was hard time.
Yeah. Hard time. And according to the Innocence Project, there are like 20,000 wrongfully convicted people in prison at any given time.
Wow.
And
wow.
I'm surprised it took so long for him to get out. And I was sort of struck by the idea that when a white woman is harmed or lots of white women are harmed, it's almost like, and I'm taking, this is a big swing, a big generalization, but the powers that be devote all of the resources and then some to get the guy and stop white women from being hurt. You know what I mean?
That and the baby.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. White women and white babies.
Yeah.
And so that sort of struck me because there may have been reasons to investigate the husband, but there wasn't enough reason to convict him.
Yeah.
And that is fucked up. Also, Parker's confession, I did listen to recordings of him speaking. I don't know if it was his confessions or police interviews or whatever, but
just speaking.
Yeah. He sounded very like matter of fact. Very clinical, absent of emotion. And it made me wonder if like all that loss that he suffered as a young kid, like the lights went out on the part of his being that was capable of connection and empathy.
Yeah.
and all the really human emotions.
Like
that,
he just shut it off
yeah,
back
it just,
then.
Yeah, it just turned off. And so.
And which would answer why he was such a good Marine.
Oh my God. I'm done. I'm retired. That's it. This episode's going to the Hall of Fame. We're never recording again. Yeah. Wow. For real.
I mean, they said it was like a kind of a high pressure position he was in, and he got praise for, you know, his work.
Yeah. Whoa, friend. Perfect for the Marines. Also on the serial killer bingo card.
Yeah, the military.
Yeah, yep. Military service and head injuries. Wow.
Yep.
Okay, well, let us know what you think. You know how to find us. Now we're going to move on to the How Not to Get Murdered section of our show. If you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
So looks like you've got a good tip here, Beth. What is it?
Well, my only thought was, going through this story was keep your windows and your doors locked.
Absolutely.
At all times. Mm-hmm. And, I've talked about that before, how I lock every goddamn thing I can.
Yeah. You know what is I lock the door as soon as I open and close it. Like I always lock doors behind me. And I've gotten into trouble with, old Whitey being mad that he's locked out of the house. But I mean, what's the alternative? I don't want to get murdered. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
it just becomes a habit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I also found a link for DIY ways to secure your home. And I'll put it in the show notes.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. Now that summer is approaching, more people will have their windows open. And so you got to consider a way to get through the summer and be safe.
Yes.
Safe girl summer. Ow. So now we're going to get into the shout out portion where we shout out any content by people of color, or any marginalized folks, or any true crime goodies. And I've got a true crime goodie and content by a person of a marginalized background. And it's a podcast called The Tea is Toxic, hosted by AJ, who is a Black woman. And it's about people, celebrities, and historical moments in time that were toxic and unforgettable.
Ooh.
And then the other thing I wanted to shout out was an Instagram account, an Instagram or TikTok, that is just a fun follow. So it's called Black Menaces, like Dennis the Menace, but Black Menaces.
Right.
And it's like a social media activist group of students at BYU, the Mormon college in Utah. And apparently Black kids do go there. Anyway, they interview other students on camera about race, faith, equity, and political topics. And all they mean to do by being quote unquote menaces is just asking uncomfortable questions and pushing students around them to grow.
To think about.
Yeah. To think about stuff. All these things. Yeah. Because these Black kids have to think about this stuff all the time. So.
Yeah. Nice.
What do you got?
Oh, I just wanted to shout out a show called Criminal Record on Apple Plus. It's a British crime thriller series starring Peter Capaldi and Cush Jumbo.
Okay.
It's set in London and deals with themes such as police brutality, racism, miscarriages of justice, and misogyny. And I haven't finished it yet, but so far it's really good. Like, I'm on the edge of my seat to figure out what's going on.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, whenever I hear that Beth is like super captivated by something, that's all I know. It's like, it's got to be really good. Like, it's undeniable at this point.
It's good. Yeah. And Peter Capaldi he's
a
kind of an asshole.
Oh.
No, no. He's not a snack. No.
No. No snacks.
Sorry,
detected?
Peter.
Oh, no.
Sorry, Peter. He's an older guy, but he is so good. He's such a good actor.
Oh.
And he plays kind of an asshole in this show. And the looks. Oh, my God. He's so good.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So I can't wait until it's off of Apple Plus. But for now.
And somewhere else. Yeah. For now, that's where you find it.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. So just to recap, that is The Tea is Toxic, a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. An Instagram or TikTok account, just for fun, called Black Menaces. And a TV program on Apple Plus called Criminal Record. Oh, my, that's the end of the program. No big deal. We'll be back. In the meantime,
we'll be back.
Yeah,
yes.
Where can the people find us, Beth?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show. Also, join us on Patreon, where we have literally hundreds of hours of bonus content.
And you can join us for stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We're doing a video club soon. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if you're in the right tier, you can join us on the video club. Yeah.
Absolutes.
And you can also support us by supporting our sponsors or by giving us a 5-star review.
5 stars only, please.
Also, don't forget to subscribe.
Mm-hmm. And if you are listening to us and you're subscribed to Fruit Loop Serial Killers of Color on Google Podcasts, you got to find a new podcast app and subscribe to us there.
Yeah. It's being sunset.
Yeah. It's sad because I really like Google Podcasts.
Yeah. It was my favorite.
In my head, I'm thinking that Google's going to be like, just kidding. We won't get rid of it. Too many people like use it, but they probably are not. So I too have to find a new app.
Yeah.
But this is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there. Deal, 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 deal. No deal, deal.
No deal.
Okay, quick sip.
Having
maybe
trouble
you're still,
with frogs
maybe
in
your
my throat.
Cough is not as gone as you think
still,
it is.
Still hanging out.
I rebuke
out.
You, cold.
Doing drugs.
Doing drugs. Yes. And then he just went with it. At about... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I don't know why. I was going to start reading your part.
Oh.
Go
if
ahead.
You want
sorry.
To, you can. Okay. Jazz. As is there low- jazz in it? Do we get any jazz? Is there any jazz in the story? I'll stop.
No. Okay. There's no jazz in
okay.
the story.
Hang it. Sad face. Sad face emoji. I saw we. Wow. And that's really all I can think about right now. Deborah C.
Nope.
Blah, 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 blah. On October 20th, 19th.
Sorry.
That's okay. No, I saw myself making the mistake and then thought I could recover by speaking more, and I couldn't. So
you and me.
Yeah.
What'd you together.
Yeah.
You with blood type.
You said to me once, because we were doing a blood drive at work or something, and I was like, hey, what type are you? And you were like, I don't know. So I remember like this. Oh, positive? And I was like, what a good way to remember. And I'll never forget it now.
That's hilarious.
Do you even remember that exchange?
I don't. Okay. I don't. But I believe you.
Okay. All right. Ta-ta. Love you. Night-night.
Love you too.
Bye.
Bye.
Something is creeping in. Don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy. And you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing
that were all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt K-L-O-O-G-H-L-E-S-S.
From DNA testing to the Dixie Mafia, Crime Capsule brings you new stories of true crime in American history. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Join us for exclusive interviews with authors from Arcadia Publishing, writing the hottest books on the most chilling stories of our country's past. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Crime Capsule, history so interesting, it's criminal.